So nice to have you back, Ambassador, on this
podcast. Good to be with you, Nima.
And as we talk, we've learned that Israelis are attacking Beirut. They're talking about they have targeted the headquarters of Hezbollah. And here is what the IDF is talking about.
Months ago, the Israel Defense Forces carried out a precise strike on the central headquarters of the Hezbollah terror organization that served as the epicenter of Hezbollah's terror. Hezbollah's central headquarters was intentionally built under residential buildings in the heart of the Dahiya in Beirut, as part of Hezbollah's strategy of using Lebanese people as human shields. On October 8th, Hezbollah started attacking Israel. After almost a year of Hezbollah firing rockets, missiles, and suicide drones at Israeli civilians, after almost a year of Israel warning the world and telling them that Hezbollah must be stopped, Israel is doing what every sovereign state in the world would do if they had a terror organization that seeks their destruction on their border, taking the necessary action to protect our people so that Israeli families can leave their homes safely and securely.
Yeah.
Well, there are a number of factors that have to be brought out. First of all, one of the most notable aspects of the exchanges of fire between Hezbollah and Lebanese and the Israelis has been that Hezbollah has been very, very careful to aim only at military installations. It has not aimed at civilian installations. It is following the laws of war as it understands them. Israel, by contrast, routinely attacks civilians. And we just heard again this charge that something that was bombed was using Lebanese human beings as human shields. Well, this is absolute nonsense because basically they're attacking a residential area. You've seen what they did in Gaza. They're trying to do the same thing in Lebanon. There are a couple of aspects of this. One is that the Israelis are talking about creating a buffer zone in the style of Gaza in South Lebanon, which is a very densely populated area. In other words, they intend to flatten it as they have flattened Gaza and make it unlivable. A zone on their border. This isn't going to solve anything. If they manage to move the border north, as they have long wanted to do, because they covet the water supplies in Lebanon, it will just mean that their enemies are on a different border. Israel has no respect whatsoever for civilian life. It's demonstrated that in Gaza. It's now demonstrating it in Lebanon. So that is a very Orwellian statement by the good Major General.
And we've seen that Netanyahu at the UN, he was talking about peace. Israel seeks peace. Do we have, because so far, any attempt on the part of the United States, other countries to make some sort of negotiations between some sort of political settlement between Gazans, Palestinians, and Israel was failed because of his policy and his administration's policy, and how we can understand this type of argument on his part?
Well, by peace, he means pacification. He means submission to Israeli might by Israel's victims, the Palestinians, the Lebanese, the Syrians. That's the sort of peace that Israel wants. It is very much as Tacitus wrote, they make a desert and call it peace. That is what they have done to Gaza. So this is a very Orwellian use of language on Mr. Netanyahu's part. It's not unusual at all. He spoke to what was essentially an empty hall at the United Nations General Assembly. Almost everybody walked out, but he brought with him some hostage families who whooped and hollered and applauded when he said all the when he issued all the lies that he did, because his speech was just a pack of lies. And it's very obvious from that, that all of this was that he was using the United Nations as a stage from which to appeal to Israeli domestic politics, because it had absolutely no impact on people beyond Israel. Israel, as the walkout demonstrated, has succeeded in becoming the most hated country on earth. And, you know, all you have to do to become hated is to do hateful things. And Israel keeps doing them. And its latest assaults on Lebanon are an example. One question, which remains unresolved, we've heard various statements about why, what was the reason for the timing of the Israeli terrorist attack on Lebanon through walkie-talkies and pagers. But, you know, I think it's pretty clear. I thought at the time, it's pretty clear if you're going to attack someone, the first thing you try to do is disrupt their command and control and their communications. So I don't think this was an accidental move or that it was provoked because, as somebody said, the Hezbollah was beginning to discover that the pagers had been booby-trapped. I think it was a cold-blooded preparation for what we're now seeing, which is efforts to wipe out part of Beirut, but also to do to southern Lebanon what Israel has done to Gaza. And it is able to do this because it has basically destroyed Gaza. Gaza is nothing now. We don't know how many people have died in Gaza. It's well over 200,000. This 40,000 figure that we keep hearing is nonsense. Some people say that the total is probably close to 500,000 dead and wounded, which means about a fourth of the population of Gaza. And that this is the model that they're now going to apply to Lebanon unless somebody stops them.
Yeah, we've learned that two brigades and various battalions, they're moving these people, these soldiers to the border, close to the border of Lebanon. Do you think that right now, are they considering any sort of advice on the part of the Biden administration?
No, and I don't think they ever have. I think Netanyahu has nothing but contempt for the United States government and Mr. Biden in particular. And he just feels free to ignore everything that people in the United States say. There's no change there. I think the troops are being moved north. Many people have said that Israel would be crazy to go in on the ground again in Lebanon. When it has done it before, it has been very badly hurt. But I think if they are going to take a chunk of southern Lebanon and basically turn it into a desert, free of people and buildings and everything else, a free fire zone, if you will, much like the one they created in Gaza years ago. You remember the Great March of Return when people in Gaza tried to approach the fence, the wall that was holding them in the concentration camp called Gaza. What the Israelis did, they just shot everybody, kids in the head or in the legs to cripple them. I think they're going to try to turn southern Lebanon into a similar free fire zone. If that's the intention, Mr. Netanyahu has absolutely no interest in peaceful coexistence with Lebanon any more than he does with the Palestinians. His objective is to get rid of the Palestinians, not to make peace with them.
Yeah. And the vice president of Iran gave an interview, and he was talking about what Iran would do and what Hezbollah would do in terms of to respond Israelis. Here is what he said.
Exercise restraint when Israel conducted military operations against Iran, conducted terrorist operations, killing the leader of Hamas, who was attending the inauguration of our president, of all things, and we exercised restraint. We believe that Hezbollah is capable of defending itself. It has been exercising restraint in not doing so. It is the responsibility of the international community to come in before Hezbollah has to take its defense into its own hands, and maybe the situation will get out of hand at that time.
Yeah. What should we expect from the international community right now? Because he's talking about...
I don't think you can expect much. There's no evidence that anybody really is prepared to do anything. The U.S. Military apparently have made a point of saying they are not providing intelligence support to the Israeli army in its Lebanon operations, but that isn't stopping them from providing bombs and servicing the aircraft that are dropping them. In practical terms, the U.S. has pulled back a little bit from all-out support of Israel. But it's continuing to supply the weapons that Israel is using to kill civilians in Lebanon, as it did in Gaza. So there's no real change on the part of the United States so far. This is an issue, a subterranean issue, if you will, in our presidential election. A lot of people have strong feelings about this, and on both sides. Those who favor Israel and those who are opposed to genocide and mass murder. But the candidates are not talking about this because they're beholden to money from very wealthy people who support Israel. So they don't want to talk about it. I don't see any other sign of fortitude, any reversal of the sort of cowardice we've seen from the international community in prospect. The U.S. still exercises a veto on behalf of Israel. I think some Europeans, the British, for example, are wavering a bit. The French joined with the U.S. in a peace proposal, which Netanyahu immediately rejected. But nobody's doing anything effective.
Yeah. And in your opinion right now, Hezbollah, because everybody's asking why Hezbollah is not responding the way that everybody have expected to do, to come from Hezbollah. And can we understand their behavior right now?
Well, it's getting a little difficult to understand because of the ferocity of the Israeli attack. I think Hezbollah, I noted that Zarif, the vice president for strategic affairs in Iran, said Hezbollah can take care of itself, and Hezbollah has been very restrained, which is true. Reading between the lines, I think Hezbollah has been told by Iran, look, do everything possible not to widen this war. And in the meantime, as I said, Hezbollah is hitting only military targets. One of the lies that is out there is that Hezbollah attacked and killed a playground with 12 Druze in it in the Golan Heights. This was, I think, those who've investigated this discovered that was a stray Israeli interceptor, not a Hezbollah rocket. Hezbollah has never attacked the Golan Heights, and it certainly wouldn't attack fellow Arabs if it could avoid it. We're seeing Israel, as usual, creating a very disproportionate situation in terms of the number of people killed and the type of people who are being killed. And we're seeing Hezbollah, true to form, being very restrained still. That's hard to understand. I think we're coming close to some tipping point. Here we are, the world as a whole, the United States in particular, has very poor communications with Hezbollah. We're not in a position to influence it. The only country that has the potential to to influence Hezbollah is Iran. And as I said, I listened to Zarif. I think he was suggesting that Iran is still cautioning Hezbollah to be patient and restrained.
Yeah. And the other question would be, it seems that most of the Hezbollah's facility, their equipment, their headquarters is underground, but they're hitting these buildings. Do you really believe that they're killing Hezbollah, or they know what they're doing?
It's not clear that they know what they're doing, and it's not clear what those buildings are. I mean, you know, they have, just recall all of the lies they issued is they destroyed every hospital in Gaza. You know, these are headquarters of Hamas and so forth, and underneath them were huge Hamas facilities. There was never any proof of any of this. Now they have established a very good record of lying about many things. There's very little reason to believe them. It is said that Hezbollah in Lebanon has built a tunnel complex, which is vastly more sophisticated and even larger than the tunnel complex in Gaza, much of which remains intact, by the way. Even after all a year of bombing. So I don't know what they hit. They have killed a lot of people in Hezbollah's ranks, including some very senior people. You know, maybe they are able to time things so that people are above ground and get killed. But absent some independent source to verify what Israel says, basically you should distrust everything they say.
The main issue that they're talking about, Netanyahu as and his commanders are talking about, is to send these people, Israelis, to the northern part. That's why they're attacking Hezbollah, because so far we haven't seen Hezbollah attacking this civilian in the northern part. But if we accept what would be their main objective in this, considering these attacks, what they're not considering just some sort of negotiations through Iran, the United States, and because as you mentioned, there is nothing left in Gaza, and what they want to do in Gaza.
It's very clear what they want to do. They have now said they're going to annex the northern part of Gaza. They're going to settle it with Israeli settlers. They will confine the population, those Gazans who survive, to a much smaller area in the south. They have basically made Gaza unlivable. They will focus on annexing and developing, if you will, the northern part. All this business about their aim being to destroy Hamas was, as we all know, a euphemism for destroying the Palestinians who are there. This was a concentration camp in Gaza, a prison, if you will. It has become an extermination camp. It is as much an extermination camp as any of the Nazi camps, Auschwitz and the others, that killed the ancestors of some of the people who are engaged in genocide in Gaza now. It's very hard to believe, but they are extremely self-righteous and convinced of their own rectitude. They have absolutely no empathy. They have declared Palestinians not to be human, but to be animals. And I think they feel the same way about the Lebanese.
Yeah. And if Hezbollah decides to respond to Israel the way that Israel was attacking them, how, and without anybody getting involved in the conflict, what would be the reaction on the part of the United States if they feel that Israel is just losing the fight?
You know, it's very hard to say. Mr. Biden is still the president. He is, by his own admission, a proud Zionist, a steadfast supporter of Israel. Very hard to say. The Congress is obviously, as Pat Buchanan years ago said, Israeli occupied territory. Capitol Hill is Israeli occupied territory. So the tendency in American politics would be to come to the aid of Israel. I think this would be extremely divisive under current circumstances, because there's a growing number of people, many of them Jewish, who want nothing to do with Israel. Majority of the American people oppose providing weapons to Israel now. So I don't know what we would do. I can't say.
Yeah. And here is Donald Trump talking about Iran being involved in the assassination, those attempted assassination against him. He said that Iran wanted to assassinate him. Here is what he said.
Two assassination attempts on my life that we know of, and they may or may not involve, but possibly do, Iran. But I don't really know, can't be sure, because in the first case in Butler, Pennsylvania, great place, and we're going back to Butler, by the way, we're going to go back and finish our speech.
Yeah.
So actually, the first assassination attempt in Butler, Pennsylvania, appears to have no foreign connection at all. The second one, at the golf course in Florida, was by someone associated with the Azov Brigades, the extreme right ultranationalist element in Ukraine, not Iran. So this is all baloney. He's just playing to the crowd because most Americans have a very negative image of Iran. They know nothing about Iran, but they have a negative image of it based on years of hostility. And this is reciprocated, of course, by many Iranians in terms of their vision of the United States. He's just playing politics with these assassinations, asking for a kind of pity vote, I suppose.
Yeah. And here is the reaction that Zarif was talking about this, that if the Iran was involved in that.
I want to move more broadly. I want to talk about the U.S. We have elections coming up, because there have been allegations that I need you to be able to respond to on the record, which is that former President Trump has said that he has been briefed by U.S. intelligence officials. His campaign announced they were briefed by U.S. intelligence officials on real and specific threats by Iran to assassinate Trump in order to destabilize the United States. I have to give you the opportunity to refute.
Well, the Iranian government has refuted that officially, and I once again refute that. We don't send people to assassinate people. I think that's a campaign ploy in order to get former President Trump out of the not so favorable situation he's in the elections. But it's not for me to decide who is going to win in the American elections. That's for the American people to decide. And Iran doesn't have a preference in this election. We don't exercise intervention in the internal affairs of other countries, unlike the United States, which does that every so often. But we don't do that. We don't interfere in the U.S. elections. It's up to the American people to decide who will run their country.
Yeah.
You know, Zarif has always been very articulate. He's a good spokesman for Iran. He was a good foreign minister. You just saw him very gently deflect these absurd charges.
Yeah, because we know these people, the Zarif team and these people who came to power in Iran are so willing to talk with Americans. They want a better relationship with Americans. Right now, it seems if Donald Trump wins, that just sabotage all the attempts on their part.
I'm not sure that that's the case. You know, the irony here is that there are a great many people abroad who hope that Trump will win because they think he will be enormously damaging to the United States and our position in the world. And I know I would remind you that Mr. Trump, you know, actually went to Korea, stepped over the line at the demilitarized zone to meet with Kim Jong-un. You know, he's pretty unpredictable. He's quite capable of making peace with Iran if he decides there's something in it for him. Maybe a skyscraper of some kind in Tehran with Trump on it. I mean, seriously, this is not worth spending any time on. I think Zarif is entirely correct. It is has to do with our election and nothing else.
The same thing, Ambassador, the same thing coming from Russians, from Iranians, from Chinese, because it doesn't seem that would much influence, that wouldn't much influence the relationship, the policy of the United States toward these countries. That's why they don't have any sort of preferences in the U.S. presidential election.
Well, there's no, from their point of view, for the most part, there's not much difference between the candidates. Trump, obviously, I think probably the Russians would be very happy if Trump was elected and in the first 24 hours capitulated to Russia in Ukraine, sacrificed the Ukrainians on the spot, which he's pretty much said he would do, that they'd be happy about that. But they'd be very unhappy about Kamala Harris's hardline policies. She has just joined the crowd arguing for a tougher policy toward Russia. And she clearly, in all of the meetings internally in the White House as vice president, was on the side of the hardliners. So China, there's no difference at all between them. They're both very anti-Chinese. Iran? No. Trump, tore up the JCPOA, the nuclear deal, put on a lot of sanctions on Iran. He's obviously using Iran as a prop in the election. As I say, he's unpredictable. So maybe he might do something that was welcome to Iran, other than continuing to mess up U.S. Reputation internationally. That's what the four countries the United States has pushed in together, Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea, all welcome Mr. Trump's clumsy efforts at international policies, which alienate allies and make adversaries even more hostile than they were. So I don't see any basis for this at all. And I don't see why they would gain anything by getting rid of Mr. Trump or Ms. Harris, for that matter. You know, there's a lot of sensitivity, obviously, to, as in Zarif in his answer reflected this, the United States routinely engages in regime change operations. And we charge others with trying to influence our politics in improper ways, doing what we do abroad, in other words. This is called mirror imaging. We look in a mirror and we look at the foreigner and we see ourselves. Well, I just don't believe it. And I know that with all of the efforts that the Russians allegedly made in 2020 and 2016, there's no evidence at all that it had any effect it whatsoever on the vote. So I think this is, again, an aspect of American domestic politics that is pretty unattractive.
Yeah. And in Russia, they're talking about new strategy in terms of the use of nuclear weapons. And how influential would that be in terms of the U.S. foreign policy, in terms of sending long-range missiles to Ukraine?
There was widespread expectation that when Keir Starmer went to Washington, there would be an announcement of giving Ukraine permission and authorizing the use of at least Storm Shadow, possibly other weapons, to fire deep into Russia. That didn't happen. And if you look at the film of the meeting where Mr. Biden was meeting with Starmer in the White House, you will see Mr. Biden very out of sorts, ill-tempered, obviously very unhappy. I thought at the time, and I still think this is plausible, although there's no proof, that in fact, after Mr. Putin made the statement he did, which was, we would be at war with the United States and NATO if these long-range weapons were used against Russia, after he made that public statement, I am pretty sure there must have been a private communication to the White House and to Mr. Starmer that was sufficiently credible to deter their announcing the authorization for Ukraine to fire these weapons. And I know that Mr. Zelensky continues to want that. He's not getting it. He may get it in an October 12th meeting that is now scheduled, I gather, with Mr. Biden. But I think there has been back channel or diplomatic communication from Russia that is sufficiently convincing that it has intimidated the White House and persuaded them this is a risk they should not take.
Yeah. And Biden had a meeting with Zelensky today. He has a meeting with Donald Trump. And hear what Biden said in that before that meeting.
Welcome back to the White House. Welcome back to the Oval Office. Got to see each other yesterday. And you shared a preview of your plan to win this war. And that's exactly what we're going to discuss today. Now, Ukraine, how is Ukraine going to prevail in this conflict? And I see two key pieces. First, right now we have to strengthen Ukraine's position on the battlefield. And that's why today I'm proud to announce a new $2.4 billion package of security assistance. I've also directed the Pentagon to allocate all the remaining security assistance funding that has been appropriated to Ukraine, period, by the end of my term, which is January 20. And this will strengthen Ukraine's position in future negotiations. Second, we look ahead to help Ukraine succeed in the long term. As you know better than anyone, as we said at the Washington summit, we have to support Ukraine in its path to membership to both the EU and the NATO, and continue to make reforms to counter corruption and strengthen democracy, which you're working mightily on right now. We have to ensure Ukraine has sufficient capabilities. I mean, sufficient capabilities to defend against future Russian aggression.
Yeah. And
it's encouraging that there's discussion of preparing for negotiations, because that is obviously what Ukraine has to do. The prospect that it can strengthen its position at the negotiating table before January 20th, as the appropriated weapons arrive, is very poor. It is actually weakening its position at the moment. The effort to invade or create an incursion into Kursk, as I've said, drawing on American history, resembles nothing so much as the Confederate States of America under Robert E. Lee attacking Gettysburg and Pennsylvania, first of all, to buck up Southern morale, second, to convince the British to continue their clandestine support for the slave states in the South, and third, to influence the morale of the North. And of course, this turned out, it was a tactically brilliant maneuver, so was Kursk. But it turned out to be a strategic blunder that hastened the defeat of the Confederacy. And I think Kursk is hastening the defeat of Ukraine. If you look at what is happening on the ground in the Donetsk Oblast, you see the Russians advancing with a speed that has not previously been seen in this war. And the reports even from Ukrainian sources, who tend to be very propagandistic generally, are more and more realistic about the front crumbling. So I think Mr. Biden is reacting to Mr. Zelensky's demands, but he's also saying, hey, I'm gone on January 20th. You know, so between now and January 20th, I'm going to do things so I can't be blamed for what is obviously happening. And Mr. Zelensky, you're going to have to negotiate. And it's up to you to strengthen your position in the at the negotiating table. Well, here I will repeat what I've said before. There has never been an instance of which I'm aware in which people have regained at the negotiating table what they lost on the battlefield. So there's going to have to be a negotiation, yes, and it's going to be largely on Russian terms. And the only question is, I think, will Mr. Putin see the merits of courting future relationship with Ukraine that is less hostile? Now, the other part is, of course, Biden reiterating that Ukraine should get into the European Union. That is something that Russia has never opposed. So that's really not an issue. It is an issue, as Sikorsky, Radoslav Sikorsky in Poland inadvertently revealed, you know, it's going to take a decade or more, long, long time. There are many obstacles. Ukraine is not a democracy. Ukraine is not free of corruption. Ukraine has many, many policies that are inconsistent with your membership in the European Union, not least of which is its suppression of linguistic minorities, Russians, Hungarians, Romanians, so forth. So that is between the EU and Ukraine, and Russia is no obstacle to it, and the United States has no say in it. As for membership in NATO, that is clearly not going to happen. And no matter how many times we say it, it is not going to happen. Russia has demonstrated that it will go to war to stop that. We have shown that we will not go to war with Russia to defend Ukraine. We will give Ukraine weapons in the hope that it can hurt Russia, isolate and weaken Russia, as Lloyd Austin once injudiciously said. So this is all talk aimed at the exit on January 20th, 2025. I will be gone. My successor is going to inherit this problem. Let him or her figure out how to deal with it. And I would, if I were Mr. Zelensky, I would be pretty alarmed by this. But then, you know, he faces great opposition now within his own country from people who don't think he's mishandled the war. There are over a million people have died in this war for nothing. And most of them were Ukrainians, actually. So his country's been depopulated, its economy's been wrecked. There are no gains for Ukraine in this. And so he's now being told, okay, we're near the end, and the end is going to be a negotiation, and you've got a few months to try to strengthen your hand. And it's not going to happen.
And there are two articles, Ambassador, recently in Bloomberg and Financial Times. Both of them are pointing at that the ties between Iran, Russia, and China is getting stronger and is of huge concern for Washington. And we know we have two candidates right now. And do you see any sort of potential in these two candidates and their policy and their team and the people who are supporting them, the political decision makers of these two campaigns, that they're capable of understanding of the nature of what's going on between these three countries and what in terms of sanctions, in terms of wars, these type of war of this policy of war against Russia, China, and Iran in the Middle East. How can they manage this, in your opinion? And do you see any sort of potential in these two candidates?
Well, they're very different on this basic issue. I should say at the outset that it was entirely predictable that if the United States bracketed China and Russia and put pressure on both of them, that they would find common cause to oppose the United States. It's also pretty obvious why Iran, which has been fiercely opposed by the United States, and North Korea would find common cause with both China and Russia in opposing the United States. So this is a case where it was predictable. Some people, including myself, predicted this. It's still in process. There's no evidence that anybody in a position of authority in the United States is willing to face up to the fact that we caused this. And so we are, you know, I think it is really almost as absurd as the famous joke about the man who killed his parents and then appealed for mercy because he was now an orphan. You know, I mean, really, this is not very credible. Now, to the two candidates. Donald Trump is very transactional and very unhappy with NATO, doesn't seem to think NATO should exist, believes the United States should withdraw from Europe. I think if we did that in the right way, it could benefit us. But I don't see any evidence that he knows how to do that without destabilizing things very badly. It's clear that he has an entourage, people with him, who are fiercely anti-China. His proposal for trade policy includes a proposal for China of 60% or 100% tariffs, which he somehow manages to believe, or at least claim, are being paid by the Chinese. Of course not, they are being paid by the importers, the American consumer. So quite aside from the damage this would do to the U.S. economy, if he actually could get that through the Congress, I think this is a retreat from involvement in foreign affairs, not an advance. And it basically, just like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump opposed and from which Donald Trump withdrew us after he was elected president. That was a default. Since then, the countries of Asia, the Pacific Asia, have gone ahead with other schemes, worked out new rules for investment and trade, and the United States is not seated at the table. We are not part of the process. We have made ourselves irrelevant. A good deal of what Mr. Trump seems to want to do internationally would make us even less relevant than we are now. And we are far less relevant now than we were a decade ago. Kamala Harris, on the other hand, seems to be stuck in the Biden track. Biden is a Cold Warrior who hasn't really adapted to the post-Cold War era. He exaggerates American influence and capacity. He underestimates the capacity and influence of others. There is his legacy is, contrary to what he said at the United Nations, is a brutal, destructive, unnecessary war and the destabilization of Europe in Ukraine because of a refusal to negotiate or to talk with an aggrieved party, the Russians. You don't have to agree with the Russians to understand that it would have been far better to accept talks than to provoke them into a military operation, where they too have suffered, of course. In China, he has left he's consolidated the bad relationship that occurred under Mr. Trump. You know, there is an obsession in the United States with credibility abroad. So the credibility that we're talking about is the credibility we have in Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, so forth. We have no credibility with the Chinese. And sooner or later, they're not going to go away. Sooner or later, we're going to have to deal with them if we are to address global regional problems. If we are to have a decent relationship bilaterally, if we are to have any influence on them, we have to regain the credibility we have lost. There's no effort to do that. I would say the Biden administration's diplomacy has been the weakest within memory. It has not been denunciatory. It's not Secretary of State Pompeo running around insulting everyone, but it has achieved no results. In the Middle East, we have become complicit in genocide. We are a party to a genocide in Gaza, and an incipient genocide in the West Bank, and a likely genocide in the, or mass murder in southern Lebanon. So I think to claim that our prestige has grown is stretching things quite a bit. And finally, with regard to Iran, Mr. Biden said he was going to restore the JCPOA. He was going to get back to cooperating with Iran to control non-proliferation in the Middle East. He has not done that. So he's finally making one trip to Africa, which he has essentially neglected during his time in office. He did have a big meeting with Africans, but no follow-up. In Latin America, where you are, relations are very poor. The effort to produce regime change in Venezuela has not succeeded. The aftermath of a similar effort in Bolivia is ongoing. Relations with your country, Brazil, are not good. The United States is widely criticized by Latin Americans for its policies in the Middle East and elsewhere. So relations with Russia are terrible. They're almost non-existent. Relations with China are, we're on speaking terms, but barely. No substantive accomplishments. Relations with Latin America have deteriorated. Relations with Africa have not advanced. And Europe is now divided and unstable and in the middle of a war. So what kind of legacy is this? Kamala Harris shows no desire, at least during the campaign, to break with this record. So I don't see, I can see Mr. Trump withdrawing us from the world in some kind of neo-isolationist move. I can see Kamala Harris continuing the overextension and over-militarization of U.S. foreign policy. And I don't think either course is going to benefit my country at all.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us today, Ambassador. Great pleasure, as always.
Nice to be with you again. I wish you could come up with some happy topics, Nima.
See you soon, Ambassador.
Okay. Bye.